Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, one lawmaker talks about a new law that may promote life-saving organ donations, and another weighs in on dedicated funding for transportation. Plus, the governor promotes economic growth, and young people from across America compete at the Capitol. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. People in Minnesota who want to help another by donating one of their organs, like a kidney, or providing bone marrow, have faced uncertainty when it comes to future premiums for life, disability, and long-term care insurance. Governor Tim Walz recently signed into law a bill that prevents insurance companies from discriminating against donors.
This next piece of legislation we're going to sign was the living donor and organ transplant bone marrow donors. These are folks that have advocated to make sure that living donors, bone marrow donors, were not discriminated against in getting insurance or long-term care for their selfless service. Representative Herr, Senator Dietzick, the folks who helped make this piece of legislation possible, but the advocates that you see here, recipients and donors of life-saving treatment. And we were just discussing before we came out here, the selfless humanity that goes into being a donor for someone else is simply kind of the highest form of humanity.
I think this legislation highlights at its core what it means to be Minnesotan. It is how we show up and how we care about each other, how we give of ourselves to support one another, and with these legislators and these advocates, removing those barriers so that we can be at the core of who we are, people who are giving of ourselves, are selfless in this act.
This bill is important to me because I have friends who need kidney transplants. So I have been tested. I encourage other people to be tested to see if I'm a match. I wasn't, unfortunately. I've also on the bone marrow list in case somebody needs that. So I just encourage people to do that. And I want to thank all the advocates because this is so important. This saves lives.
This piece of legislation is actually really personal to me. I am somebody who has a kidney disease. I've had one since I was 16 years old, and I know that one day I will need a transplant. And for those who step up to help those who are in need, that we need to make sure that they are protected. I could not have done this work without the National Kidney Foundation and my partners here in Minnesota. This is critical and necessary work, and I really want to thank all of my colleagues in the legislature for making this a bipartisan effort, and that we were able to pass this through with almost unanimously within both the House and the Senate. And so just thank you all for being here and lifting up this piece of very important legislation.
Senator Kari Dietzick was one of the co-authors of the anti-discrimination bill, and she joins me now in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
About 20 states have enacted anti-insurance discrimination laws to prevent organ and bone marrow donors from being adversely impacted in the life insurance, long-term care, and disability insurance market because of their decision to donate. How did you get involved?
So I got involved because I have friends and family that are impacted by kidney disease and have had to have a bone marrow transplant. So I was kind of aware of a lot of the family concerns and concerns of people that want to donate, want to get tested to donate, but they have a lot of questions. And then I heard more stories about some discrimination. I don't think it was rampant, but I think, again, getting that barrier to get people to donate is so huge that anything we can do to reduce that is helpful. So that's why I got involved.
The state of Virginia passed a similar law earlier this year. A testifier there told a committee that while she was being tested to see if she would be a match for a kidney donation, she was warned that if she were to donate, she would later potentially have difficulties in buying life insurance because having only one kidney is considered a pre-existing condition. Were Minnesota donors having experiences like this, to your knowledge?
I haven't heard a lot of them, but you know, just again, to get that barrier to get people to donate is really a hurdle. And so I think reducing that to reduce their fears of donating, and will I run into health insurance impacts, and then getting you can get health insurance because the Affordable Care Act, you know, put in that you can't discriminate there. But there's other insurance, from life insurance to long-term care insurance, that we want to make sure people have that opportunity to donate and still have the be able to get that life insurance and other insurance going forward.
The new law will prohibit discrimination against donors by companies, like I said, that life insurance, long-term care insurance, disability insurance. What do Minnesotans need to understand about how this law will protect them if they do choose to donate an organ, a kidney, or bone marrow going forward?
Yes, so you can't be discriminated against. So they can't ask on the form when you go to get life insurance. They can't ask on that form, and deny you because you have donated a kidney or donated bone marrow. So I think that's a huge, it's a huge help going forward, because again, we want to cut down those barriers so that more people agree to get tested and possibly be donors.
So I think in the bill it said something about actuarial language, whatever rate is set for the insurance product, it cannot be impacted at all by any kind of donation. So it would be, let's say you did donate an organ, and otherwise you have a clean bill of health, then you need to be offered that rate that any other person who didn't donate would be offered.
Correct, yes.
And then how would a Minnesotan be able to ensure that they weren't being discriminated against?
I think that is with any good product and any good company, you ask questions. So you need to ask the questions, you need to do the research, and then again, if you get denied, they should tell you why you get denied. And so you want to do that follow-up and ask those questions, because lots of times, especially when we change the laws, like right now, people don't know. And so it is a good opportunity to inform both the company and the people that, yes, you should ask those questions to find out if you were denied, why you were denied, because they can't do that anymore.
And just incidentally, I was talking to somebody in the hall just a few minutes ago, and I mentioned that we were going to talk about this topic, and they had no knowledge that this was even an issue. So we're bringing it to light. According to the nonprofit organization, the American Kidney Fund, there are nationally about 106,000 people who are waiting for an organ transplant. They do a living donor protection report card. And Minnesota now has the grade of a B, in part because of this new law. But what more should be done? What would we have to do to get an A?
I think one good thing would be to offer paid family leave. I think that is helpful. I think a lot of people, and it kind of varies depending on what the procedure is, how much time do you need after the surgery to get and recuperate. And so I think that would be helpful. A lot of companies and a lot of states offer tax credits to the companies to encourage them and to help them, especially small businesses, to help them when an employee goes on leave or needs to take time off to do the donations. And so I think this will help move us forward, but I think we'll, paid family leave, I think, would be a good start to get us closer to that A.
At the bill signing event, you said that you have friends who are in need of organ donation and you were tested but were not a match. You encourage people to consider becoming donors. Do you think this new law will increase the numbers of people who are willing to donate?
I'm really hopeful that it is. There are a number of people that I talk to. I have family members and friends who have kidney disease. One of my friends, good friends from high school, grade school actually, has been on the kidney list for like 2 years. Wait lists up to 5 years are not unheard of. And so, as we were all talking and getting tested to see if we were a match, people had questions just from the basic, can I survive with just one kidney? And then what happens if I get sick, or what happens if I change jobs? Will health insurance impact it? And again, so explaining to the people, the Affordable Care Act prohibited health insurances from discriminating you against you. And then this bill will provide additional anti-discrimination laws to, again, help ease some of those concerns and address some of those questions that people had. And I really encourage people to get tested. So to find out if I would be a kidney donor, it was just a blood test. To find out, I had another friend who had cancer, and so she needed a bone marrow transplant. And so that was just a cheek swab with a Q-tip. And so, the test to get tested to be a donor is not that hard, but it will save lives. You have about 3,000 people in Minnesota and the Dakotas waiting on that kidney list. And so any little bit will help.
And you mentioned the bone marrow donor. Like, we know that to be a kidney donor would require surgery, and that is a daunting undertaking for sure. But what about bone marrow? Is that as invasive, or is that a simpler procedure?
It in some ways is simpler, but in some ways if it involves a spinal tap, so it kind of depends on exactly what they need. But again, the spinal tap, it is less invasive. It's a lot less invasive than it was years ago, but it's still painful. And so you still need that recovery time. So this will help. And again, maybe getting paid family leave moving forward will also help. And then it'll help get us an A in that rating.
Senator Kari Dietzick, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
At a recent event at Wyoming Machine in Stacy, Minnesota, the Council on Economic Expansion presented Governor Walz with a comprehensive roadmap to ensure the state's long-term economic growth.
Each of our 15 council members plus the three commissioners contributed diverse perspectives, and they were committed to listening to community voices, to taking in ideas and feedback from experts, and ultimately building out a 10-year vision on economic expansion that is rooted in inclusivity. This moment in our state's history is a time for transformational thinking. We heard again and again that bold changes are needed in an economy that needs to serve everyone.
What this council found, and it only reinforces what so many of us know, is that we desperately need every Minnesotan and every community in order to thrive economically. Our rural areas need the cities. Our cities need our rural areas. Our majority community needs our communities of color, and our communities of color need our majority community. We are truly in this all together.
You know, we call it a report, but in many ways, as I think you've heard already, it's not so much a report as a roadmap. It doesn't spend a lot of time kind of navel-gazing on how we got here or why we got here. It's really about where we're headed and what we need to do to build a better economy in our state. Our most pressing concern right now in state government as it relates to the economy is our workforce. We have not enough workers to fill the open jobs in our state. And we've been on the road all summer really highlighting pools of labor that are overlooked. You take a look at that record-breaking unemployment rate that we announced last Friday. The black unemployment rate actually went up last month by 0.5 percentage points. So there are available workers in pockets in the state that I think businesses could better connect with. That's our job as state government to provide some of those bridges. This is the most timely and I think near-term economic concern because it's holding back productivity if firm owners don't have enough people to hire.
It increases my sense of urgency that we get back and do a special session to solve the things that our communities are telling us to solve. And that is a big part of what this plan tells us.
Dedicated funding for roads and bridges is an ongoing conversation among lawmakers. Currently, about half of the money collected in sales tax on auto parts is directed to state road and bridge projects. Last session, Senator Jeff Howe authored a bill which passed the Senate on a vote of 59-7 that would have dedicated all of the sales tax on auto parts to transportation. I spoke with him recently and began by asking him why he took this approach.
Our road and bridges are not keeping up with the traffic that we have. And so we, you know, need to think outside the box and how to provide for that. Right now, the general fund provides about 0.4% of the general fund towards roads and bridges. You know, everything we buy, everything anybody, even if you don't drive a vehicle, what everybody relies on roads and bridges. If you buy something at Walmart, if you buy something at CVS, guess what? That came by a truck. That came on roads and bridges. So that drives me to say that the general fund needs to provide more funding to our roads and bridges because relying on the gas tax, which provides about a third of the cost, and our registration fees also provide some. What happens is we can't keep up. And we continue, our roads and bridges continue to deteriorate, so we need to think of different ways to actually make that happen. So this was a deal that I thought of. Actually, I was working on my 1997 Suburban replacing the fuel pump. And my wife came out and said, why don't you just buy a new, different one? And I thought about that as I was bloody knuckles and grease under my nails. I was laying underneath there trying to drop that big 42-gallon gas tank. And the idea was, is that it was, if I bought a different vehicle, the sales tax on that piece went to roads and bridges. But if I buy pieces and parts to keep my old vehicle on the road, that went to the general fund. That didn't make sense. To me, common sense says if it was applied to a vehicle on the road, it should go to roads and bridges.
Had this bill become law, it would have placed 86% of the sales tax revenue in the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, or HUTDF, as people around here say. The remaining 14% would have been split between town roads and small cities. Why do townships and small cities need dedicated funding?
Well, the townships have been get dedicated funding, but they struggle. They haven't been getting enough. So this would have gave them another 7% or about another $20 million, give or take a little bit. And that would have definitely helped them, because I tell you what, if you've ever been out in rural Minnesota and seen some of these township roads, there are a number of them that have minimum maintenance signs. And that might sound okay, but minimum maintenance right now means no maintenance. They struggle keeping their township roads up because farm equipment and trying to get goods to market, they all become heavier and heavier, and those roads struggle to keep up with that. Now, when we talk about small cities, there are cities under 5,000. They get no state assistance on their roads. So the only way they can fix their roads and fix those their streets is through property tax. So really, this is a great way to provide property tax relief for towns and small cities, and that's really key to this, to that proposal.
Now, I said that the bill passed 59-7. One person who objected was Senator Mary Kunish. She argued that full dedication of auto-related sales tax to transportation hurts the general fund. So in essence, you're taking money away from education, health and human services, other major budget areas. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, keep in mind, education and health and human services takes up about 75% of our $52 billion budget. And as I said before, transportation gets 0.4%. So when you look at that, just this is $300 million as opposed to they're getting billions of dollars, about $26 billion, I think, goes to education. So to say that that $300 million is really going to hurt those other funds, I don't think that's true. And I truly believe that it'll make a huge impact to really small cities, property taxes in those small cities, and it'll actually improve our road, vastly improve our road structure out in rural Minnesota. And so I think it's something that we have to do. We have to think outside the box, and I think it's only appropriate that that's where the money comes from.
Now, our transportation sector is undergoing a shift. There are increasing numbers of electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles and incentives for people to purchase such things. You also sponsored a bill last session that would have increased the surcharge for electric and hybrid vehicles. Currently, that charge is $75. Your bill would have raised it to $229 for electric vehicles, half that for hybrids. Beyond that, I mean, why should the surcharge be increased and you know, electric vehicles don't buy gas? And so how are we going to fund transportation in the future?
Well, when you look at that, we actually use MnDOT's figures and the average miles driven, the average cost, and that's how we came up with 229. We just didn't pick a number out of the sky. I mean, 229 is kind of an odd number, but that's taking the average miles driven, the average gallons per mile, all the rest of that's a miles per gallon, all the rest of that stuff we looked at to come up with that 229. And why did we go to a surcharge? Because it's easy. It's the tool in the toolbox. It's easy. People understand it. Do I like it? No, I don't. I actually, even though I proposed it, it's not my first choice. My first choice is actually a different bill that I filed, which was 1602, which actually would have added a tax to the electricity used as fuel. And it's already, that fuel would actually, that piece would automatically be dedicated to the HUTDF. And it actually makes sense because as we go to more and more electric vehicles, we need to try and we have less gas vehicles on the road, we need to be able to figure out how we're going to charge to get there. And this only makes sense to do, and we're just trying to figure out, do we do it at the charging station? Do we do it at the meter with the utility company? Do we have the utility company collect it? Do we have the charging station owner collect it? How do we do that? And where do we put the charging stations? All these are an important discussion. I'm not opposed to electric vehicles. I just think that we need to figure out how to do an equivalent tax on that electricity to ensure, and you know, who knows? Hydrogen vehicles might be the next thing. So we're going to have to figure out how to charge them also, as we have hydrogen, we've figured it out for natural gas, we've did it for propane. We need to figure this out and actually come up with a process to charge those electric vehicles on the road, because they still drive on the road. We're still gonna have to figure that out.
So definitely more to come on that front, and we'll have you back in the future to talk more about it. Senator Jeff Howe, thank you.
Thank you.
The National Judicial Competition, or NJC, sponsored by the YMCA, brings several hundred students together from across the United States to participate in either a model Supreme Court or mock trial competition. Minnesota is host this year, and I sat down with Orville Lindquist, the state program executive, and several student participants to learn more.
This is year 11 of NJC. First 10 years were either virtual because of the pandemic or in Chicago. So this is the first time it's been in Minnesota, and the first time it's been anywhere other than Chicago. Our Capitol complex and all of these great buildings are perfect. We have lots of space. It's beautiful space. It's accessible space. So we can bring these young people here and they can have a real life, true to life experience.
What do you hope that participants of this program will glean from this experience?
I hope that students learn a lot of things that help them be successful in their adult lives. Things like working together, being responsible for something like, in this case, their arguments, their presentations, knowing their facts, public speaking. And yes, it's about the law. I want people to learn and understand the law and legal process, but we're not training lawyers necessarily. Although a lot of these kids may be lawyers. This is less about law and more about things that help people be successful in life.
Now, you mentioned that kids are coming from all over the nation for this. And so there's a good, you know, a chance for kids to get to know each other. How important is that to kind of bring people together from different walks of life and have sort of a shared interest in something?
So we've got 201 students here and about 70 adults. Camaraderie is important. Being connected with different people from different parts of the country with different viewpoints is so important. It's always been important. It's really important now in a fracturing world. And so these are opportunities to build personal and social connections, as well as building, you know, work skill-based connections that happen in the courtroom. So there's free time and fun time, and then there's courtroom time. And all of that comes together in really, really important ways. That's why it's important that we're physically together in a great place.
What made you decide to be a part of the National Judicial Competition?
Well, I've always done mock trial throughout my state, and I felt like taking this to the next level, but also being able to see people that come from different areas. Like, I haven't met anybody from Minnesota or Michigan before, so just being able to talk to those people and kind of understand that we have this common interest is what I really wanted to have, and that's why I came.
I actually competed at NJC last year, except it was over Zoom, so it was definitely a very different experience. And I think that I just really enjoyed my own state's, we call it our model convention, where we competed like the same sort of activity, and I just really wanted to get back, especially at a national level, and meet new people. And the experience I had last year from NJC especially helped that, just being able to see so many different sides and just meeting new people is always great.
Are you doing the appellate court or the trial court, and why?
I'm doing the appellate court, and so Pennsylvania, actually, in our youth and government program, our judicial branch is only the appellate court. And for the past couple years, that's what I've been doing. I started there in ninth grade as an attorney for 2 years. Then in my junior year, I became a justice, and this past year at our convention, I served as Pennsylvania's Chief Justice. So just sticking with this thing, it's always been so just exciting for me, and I do thoroughly enjoy just listening to arguments and especially helping people see their confidence and see how they grow throughout the program.
I'm a part of the mock trial court, and I've been doing that since my freshman year in high school, and I'm about to be a junior.
Do you think that your experiences here will lead you to pursue education in becoming a lawyer?
I think definitely. I think this this community does a really good job of getting people interested and making them feel connected to what they're doing. So I definitely feel connected, and I feel like this is something that I could excel at, you know, as an adult.
What's your pitch to students who may be on the fence or who are just learning about this opportunity now? Why should they come and be a part of something like this?
I think it's important for you to just try, and it's something that if you don't cast your line, you're never gonna hook a fish, and I hooked a fish with NJC and mock trial, and it's something that's been really important to me, and I've loved. So I'd say everybody take that chance, be confident in what you do, just give it a try.
I think that it's mainly just you never know what's going to happen, so just not giving anything a try, you can't gain anything out of that. In my 10th grade year, actually, I almost quit our youth and government program, but 2 months later I was back in, and then I just became Pennsylvania Chief Justice, and now I'm here as a student chief, and it's just been so incredible what all the youth and government program has given back to me.
How do you think what you've learned from here will help you in your adult life?
I think transitioning into that, a lot of the communication skills I have come from this program, especially presentation and just interacting with people, and especially serving as a justice, I've been able to just kind of sense people better and be able to just get a sort of idea how people interact with each other and how our own connections will be like.
I've learned that I can prepare and be well prepared for court. I've also learned that I'm good at doing stuff on the fly, and I can trust myself to make the right decisions when I'm doing my mock trial. And
what kind of impact does a program like this, or at the state level, the youth and government program that happens annually every January, have on those kids who participate?
What I hear from my alumni, they learn more about how to do their jobs and how to live their adult lives through programs like Youth and Government and NJC. Almost than they do in school. And I'm not denigrating public education. A lot of my best friends are teachers. But schools do one thing. They have one track where they're teaching skill, they're teaching knowledge. At a place like Youth and Government where it's experiential, they practice these things. They don't just learn, they practice. And then they put the principles into practice.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.